Investigation Committee, which is based here in Oklahoma City and chaired by Charles, to bring out what we can of a much broader and more accurate picture of what really happened here.
Charles, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Well, I live in Oklahoma City, have here most of my life. I was elected to the Oklahoma House of Representatives in 1986 and served for 12 years until 1998. Of course, the bombing happened in the middle of that, and I was, like all Oklahomans and Americans, was shocked at what happened. And as I saw this terrible tragedy unfold, I, like so many other people, had a lot of questions. And I had constituents and others that were asking those questions, and had someone close to me that died in the bombing, and I eventually... But did my own investigation and started working with others that were family members of victims of the bombing and others that were close to the actual tragedy itself. And we began to work together to do our own investigation. And that's an even a longer story. I think that's going to be the subject of what we're going to talk about a little bit tonight, at least.
Exactly. And Lisa, I've not spoken to you. I've spoken to Charles online. And Chris, I've talked to off mic, but can you tell us, Lisa, how you weigh in on this whole subject?
Well, I just actually began working with Charles in last April, Charles and Chris Emery, and I had gone to the forum and met with them and brought back a lot of memories because 10 years ago, right after the Murrah bombing, I was hired by CNN and kind of just not as a writer or anything, but as I kind of escorted the people around town and showed them, you know, where everything was. So that's how I kind of got involved.
All right. Well, I'm glad you're all joining us. For most, we're going to assume that people who are listening to this believe what they've written about, what they've read that was written about what took place 10 years ago. So let's just say that if we're talking to neophytes, exactly what is your contention about what took place on that April day in 1995? Anybody's, that's a jump ball for anybody.
I'm
sorry, ask that question again, please.
I was going to say, most people, we're going to assume that people who are listening to this believe what they saw in the papers about what took place.
Right.
And maybe, I don't know, and I don't think you guys do, but I'm going to assume you don't. Otherwise, we would not be having this conversation. So what is the contention as far as you folks with what is the mainstream story about what took place that day?
Well, of course, the mainstream story is pretty simple. The federal government has claimed that Timothy McVeigh pulled the truck up in front of the building all by himself and with some minor help from Terry Nichols, who, according to them, helped build the bomb in Kansas. And then McVeigh drove the truck all alone to Oklahoma City and pulled it up in front of the Murrah building, blew up that building and killed all those people. And there's only one little small piece of truth in that story that they've perpetrated on the American public, and that is that Tim McVeigh was involved in the Oklahoma City bombing and was driving the truck when he pulled it up in front of the Murrah building that morning. What they have covered up, intentionally covered up, is the fact that there was somebody else in the truck with him as he pulled it up in front of the building, and there were a number of other people involved in this plot to carry it out. Also, that some government agencies, the ATF specifically and the FBI, probably some others, had prior knowledge that individuals were planning to carry out this bombing in the weeks and up to about a month and a half or 2 months prior to the Oklahoma City bombing, if not longer, and they failed to stop it. And it was literally and figuratively a terrible tragedy that blew up in their faces, and the results of that is many people died. And that's the motivation, to a large extent, of why they need to cover this up.
What are you hoping to exact from the federal government in regard to seeing justice done? Are we looking at, and of course, I'm a bit jaded about this, but if another commission's opened up so many times, and this is my personal feeling, when you look at the 9/11 Commission and what it did with, you know, the events in New York City, can you guys can you guys really get a fair hearing and an airing of the facts that are not going to be done behind closed doors or in secret chambers for, of course, quote, our national security?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think we a lot of Americans that are paying attention to what's going on in our country and around the world probably feel the same way, in that we wonder if we could get a fair hearing either. We've seen so much happen, and we've similar types of cases or various corruptions in the government. We've seen our government, our Congress, become very unresponsive to the people that elect them. That's a very good question. You know, can we even get anything done about this problem? I was watching the news conference that this congressman from up there in your neck of the woods, what's his name, Weldon, Kurt Weldon,
right,
from Pennsylvania, had recently, where he was just mad as he could be and upset about a lot of things related to the 9/11 case. And I remember him saying in that press conference, I don't remember his exact words, but basically said, I don't feel very comfortable or have much confidence in calling on Congress to have yet one more commission to investigate the 9/11 commission for their failures and other things related to the 9/11 and the problems that he was mentioning in that press conference. So he said he was throwing his support behind the Inspector General doing an investigation. Well, that's the problem we've got today. Who do you turn to? And, you know, when you're asking the government to investigate itself, that seems to be a major problem. It doesn't investigate itself. What it does is it covers up and it puts out propaganda to try to, you know, hide things and fool the American people about a lot of things, in my opinion. And that's my experience in the Oklahoma City bombing case.
Well, how much faith do you have right now in our federal judiciary? They seem to be more tribunal as time goes on. And if you find yourself opposed by a somewhat recalcitrant judge, can this all go down the tubes? I mean, there's a lot of obstacles in the way trying to get to the truth, is there not?
Well, yeah, let me say this, because I think on the other hand, after what I just said a second ago, I think we still have to go through the motions. We have to go through the various, you know, protocol and procedures and through the various areas of and levels of government to try to address these problems. I believe to a large degree that's why we have such big problems today, is because so many people have this, you know, sense of apathy that it doesn't do any good to try to fix things. And, what else can we do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can have radio shows like this and talk to the media, but until enough people get involved and start demanding that their elected officials address the issues that they want them to address, or kick them out of office and put somebody else in their place, we're going to get the same kind of government we've had for a long time.
Well, two things.
We have to do something. And in regards to the judiciary, there are some good judges up there. In regard to the Oklahoma City case, there's one up in Utah that's been dealing with an issue related to the Oklahoma City case on a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, in which he's required the FBI to reveal quite a few documents, unredacted documents, have revealed recently in the last 12 months or so what we've been saying for 10 years, and that is the federal government had prior knowledge. They had extensive information about Andy Strassmeyer and a number of other people that were involved in the Oklahoma City bombing and communicating with Timothy McVeigh, and they've worked very diligently to cover that up all these years.
Would this be a good time also to talk about that lawsuit? It's being brought by a lawyer whose brother was somewhat involved. Yeah, can we talk about that now? Sure.
Sure. You want to start on that, Lisa, and kind of introduce that subject?
Sure. Yeah, Jesse Trinadieu, his brother was Kenneth Trinadieu, and he was murdered at a transfer center in El Reno. The official story was that he hung himself, and Jesse sued the federal government. I believe he won a civil suit. Was it a civil suit, Charles? For $1.1 million. But then he went ahead and pursued the Freedom of Information Act papers and was constantly blocked at every turn, and finally won some kind of a judgment, and he just released like 96 pages of documents, which clearly show, you know, what Charles was saying, that Andrew Strassmeyer was probably an informant at Elohim City, and had contact with Timothy McVeigh, and that there was a Southern Poverty Law Center that stated in those papers that he was an informant for. So there's all kinds of really interesting things, and those are online. That you can actually go online and read those documents now.
Where can they access that, Lisa?
At Intel Wire. I'm sorry. Intelfiles.com. Or IntelWire.com. I'm sorry. This is a very good informative website by J.M. Berger. He's out of Massachusetts, and he's been working on the Murrah bombing for about 10 years. He worked for NPR.
Now, would you spell that out? Is that Intel with one or two L's?
It's IntelWire.com.
Okay.
He put these on his website, with a real good outline and explaining which ones, kind of what they are and in what order. Because if you get the raw documents, they're kind of hard to understand. You got to go through and read them very carefully. But he does a real good outline of them.
Let me ask you this. How did you feel the anniversary conference, if you will, took place in Oklahoma City? How do you feel that went? I mean, did it exact any more interest from the public? And what about those who are obviously had spouses and children involved in that situation? Was there any kind of galvanization that took place because of that meeting?
I went, and the second day, I didn't go the first day, but it went really well. I don't think there were enough people there. I wish more people could have been there, but a lot of the family members and victims were there, and I got reacquainted with some of them. So that's when I got involved with Charles and Chris Emery and started really working on this case. And the whole goal you were talking about earlier was, what can we do? And originally on that date, Congressman Rohrabacher had given a speech on the House floor where he was calling for congressional hearings on the Oklahoma City bombing, which still may come to fruition, we're hoping. So. Otherwise, there were a lot of family members there and victims, and I thought it went real well, good presentation. And everyone, I think, is regaining interest in the story now that Terry Nichols is coming forward with new information also.
And Charles and Chris, do you want to weigh in on the that conference, on the anniversary, and also beyond that, what about what's going on with Terry Nichols?
You know, I have to give Chris all the credit for that conference even taking place. It wouldn't have happened without Chris Emery making it happen. So, there's some people that have come along after those of us that got started in this in the very beginning and just about ran ourselves ragged into death trying to fight this battle, and Chris is at the top of the list. So what it's helped do is continue to keep the cover-up of the Oklahoma City bombing, in a public sense, out in front of the public, I should say. I think another thing that's happened is, and Chris has been real instrumental in doing this, along with some other people, is help bring people together that were either family members or victims or otherwise associated with the Oklahoma City bombing. Maybe the people that were government investigators or rescue workers or other folks that during the first 5, 6, 7 years when it was so controversial, while there were those of us like myself and others that were very public and calling the government's hand in this cover-up, we were being attacked and ridiculed and what have you by some of the media and the public officials. It acted as, in confusing a lot of people. So Chris and others have helped bring those people together over these last few years, bring together those people and help them to understand what's really happened in this case with the government covering it up and telling a lot of those folks just flat-out lies about what happened with the bombing. A lot of those family members and victims and others really believe the government was, being honest with them and doing the right thing. And it's been a tragedy within the tragedy for a lot of those people to realize that they've been, fooled and that they've been lied to and that fraud has been committed, even in the face of their loved ones being slaughtered in this case. So a lot of emotion that has been real difficult to work through the last 10 years.
Let me interject at this time that, folks, if you're listening, whether it's real time or in the archives, you can go to the website www.okcbombing.org and find out a lot about the information about which we'll speak today and more, without a doubt. You're also able to, if you wish to, instant message us at AOL. You can use this address, WDCF 1350. You can also email me at visigoth@hotmail.com. That's VYZYGOTH.com to pose a question, and I'll definitely interject that. And if you wish, I know it's on your dime, but you can call at 352-567-1009. That's 352-567-1009. We have with us today Chris Emery, Charles Key, and Lisa Gariani, and we're talking about the Oklahoma bombing that day on April 19th, 1995, when the Murrow Federal Building experienced an explosion that killed 168 people. Again, the second half of the question that I posed was, what's going on with Terry Nichols, and what information is he giving out that might change the complexion of the matter?
I think Chris Emery's on the line now.
But, I'll defer that actually to Lisa. She's been keeping up on it. What I do know is that and I'll preempt here before Lisa gets on, that Representative Rohrabacher has attempted to have conversations with Terry, and I've talked to a couple of his, one of his siblings, and who's been very close, trying to communicate with him, but we found out that the FBI is insisting on being privy on all of the conversations, which clearly shows that they have a vested interest in vetting out the truth. It is consistent with how they've treated this case from day one. But I do want to qualify that statement and let your listeners know that if it wasn't for the assistance of the local, the county, the state, and the federal level, on a lot of different officers that have come forward that were honest and very forthright and very upset on how this case has been treated, we wouldn't be where we are today. It's the top-level decision-makers that are choosing to continue to corrupt the investigation of this. Lisa, do you want to continue on with your findings with the Nichols?
Oh,
feedback?
Sure. The question referred to what Terry Nichols was trying to say or coming out with? Is that what the question?
That's correct.
Okay. These two people named Stephen Dresch and Angela Clemente apparently had information that they obtained through an informant that was placed next to Terry Nichols in his cell, named Gregory Scarpa. And there was another one, I forgot his last name. But anyhow, Gregory Scarpa was the main informant, and he got out the information that Terry Nichols had that stash at his home in Kansas that was not found by the FBI 10 years ago. So they found out the location. And the main thing, though, that what Terry wanted to emphasize when he came out with this information was that there would be certain fingerprints found on the cases of nitromethane, which is an additive, so I guess an ampho bomb that amplifies the effect of an ampho bomb. And there was a case of nitromethane in there. And he said that when they got this out of the hiding place, that Roger Moore's fingerprint and possibly Karen Anderson's fingerprints would be on the package, because he was saying that's where the ingredients came from. So that was something the FBI took them quite a while to get this information, even though these two people called congressmen, they called the FBI, they called everyone they knew, and finally got someone to listen to them. They went up there and they did get in there and find the, believe it was blasting caps and then the cases of nitromethane. But they confiscated the cases very quickly, claimed publicly, I think his name was Jeff Lanza out of the FBI out of Kansas, claimed quite publicly that the case was closed and they didn't care what Terry Nichols had to say, and they weren't going to investigate this case any further. So we will probably never get to know whose fingerprints were on anything. So as far as I know, that they're not going to come forth with that information.
Well, at this point, let me ask you this. How credible do we feel Terry Nichols is at this point? Is
well,
he very, very helpful, or, you know, just helping himself?
What does he have to lose? Is what I, when I looked at all of this, I thought, what does, you know, I mean, he's in there for life in a pretty bad situation. So I don't think he's at the point where he has anything to lose. To go ahead and come forth with some information. And he maybe feels like they, you know, it might reduce his sentence. You know, who knows what goes through these, you know, the people's minds. But then if he would go ahead and talk about, you know, the co-conspirators now, that maybe, you know, he might get another trial even. Who knows?
To add a layer to the confusion and the malfeasance and complicity of the federal authorities, we have special agent in charge here in the Oklahoma City office saying one thing, and then Mr. Lanza saying something completely different. So it shows that they're backpedaling. They're meaning the FBI and running literally to keep up with themselves to cover their lies. And we're talking about 40 or 50 lies back, and they have lost track of how many lies they've presented so far that it's to the point of being completely preposterous. And we're not believing anything they have to say anymore. They have no credibility.
Yeah, and there's one more interesting twist to this story, that Gregory Scarpa, the informant that was placed next to Terry Nichols, was also an FBI informant placed next to Ramzi Youssef, the one that was convicted of the World Trade Center bombings. And I also, on that website I just stated, they have a link to the Scarpa M302s, FBI, they're called 302s, the, you know, when they go in and type their information up. So that was another interesting twist to the story, too, was why did, you know, the FBI take this guy that was an informant and move him next to Terry Nichols? I'm sure it had something to do with the possible link to the Philippines connection. If anyone has, you know, up on this case at all, everyone knows that Terry Nichols made several trips to the Philippines. And it's been speculated that he had connections to groups in the Philippines that, you know, were terrorist organizations.
We're coming up on the half hour, and so it's a good time to say that we're listening to the Grassy Knoll in AM 1350 WDCF, AM 1400 WZHR. We have with us Chris Emery, Charles Key, and Lisa Gariani from Oklahoma City, speaking about that day in April 1995. Folks, you know, would it not be a bad time right now to ask one of you to lay out exactly what you believe happened on that day? You know, regardless, of course, I mean, we if you're listening to the show, you're not believing the mainstream take. Can I ask you to tell us what you think took place and who was involved?
Chris, you want to go first?
I'll give a quick review. I think there were at least six others in addition to McVeigh at the scene of the crime that morning. At least a few hours before, during, and several hours after. And some of these same individuals were cited at least 90 days in advance, some as early as December of 94. In addition to those six, we have peripheral information, some of it substantiated, that there were at least six others. So we're looking at 12 in addition to McVeigh and Nichols. This is a much larger crime. Physically, financially, and mentally, it would have been absolutely impossible for McVeigh and Nichols to carry this off by themselves.
All right. Anybody want to build on that?
Well, I was just going to, I'll jump in here. To be specific, some of these groups, there seems to be, there's like core groups in different parts of the country. There's the Arizona connection. There's people out there. Then there's the Arkansas connection, which was the Roger Moore, Karen Anderson, Elohim City, several other people tied to the Arkansas. And then there's like another concentric circle, which is really intriguing, is the Middle Eastern connection, which several investigators have really focused on trying to develop an international connection as far as who financed the project. You know, was it Al-Qaeda? Some have suggested it was Iraq, but as far as all that goes, what I've read, I can see a lot of circumstantial information coming out, but not any real hard evidence. The hard evidence seems to lean more towards the ARA, which was an Aryan, the bank robber, the Midwest bank robbers. There seems to be more of a connection with them, and that's coming out through Jesse Trinidou that we just spoke about, too. And as far as his brother resembled one of the ARA gang. In fact, the one that he resembled was Richard Lee Guthrie, who was also, once they did arrest him, he was found hung in his cell, similar to Jesse Trinidou's brother. So there might be something there. But as far as what motivating factor, I think if you want to kind of look into Timothy McVeigh's brain,
mm-hmm.
you can get online and read some letters that he wrote to his sister in 1993.
All right, folks, I'm going to interrupt you just for a second. We have a caller who's got a question. Caller, you're welcome to the grassy knoll.
Oh, you're killing me here.
Okay.
Hey, listen, my thing is, so you all are saying that the van that was parked in front of the Oklahoma building,
mm-hmm.
that one van was big enough to blow that much damage into that building.
No, we're not saying that.
In
fact, we have evidence to show that that was physically impossible to do that. It's been substantiated by local law enforcement as well as county, and then we have professional ballistics experts from the U.S. military. That was their job, to design ordnance to take out hard targets as large as 10 times the size of the Murrah building. And they said absolutely no way. And many of his professional colleagues that designed work for the Department of Energy and even the Manhattan Project said that it was completely ludicrous to anybody to present that story, and I expect us to believe it.
Well, I believed it when I seen it, but I don't believe it now. I mean, all this time has passed and stuff, and I don't know how to put this. You only see what you believe on TV, because that's all you ever see is what's on TV, so you don't know to go any further than that ever in your whole entire life. And then,
Correct. You
know, stuff starts happening. You start hearing some things. People at work think I'm a commie because I believe that stuff, you know? And it's so funny because it's like, how can you look at the damage that's done and believe that what you see is what's really there?
Right.
So, anyways, I just, I'm glad that there's other people out there that, like, it never even occurred to me that the Oklahoma bombing, where there was ever any connection, like, to a terrorist, like, you know, 911 and all that kind of stuff, until the other week I was talking to Keith, and he brought it up, and I was like, you know, I wouldn't even taken that walk until somebody said something to me, and then I started thinking about it, and I went, it doesn't make sense. It just doesn't. And I don't know, you know, who you're all supposed to get in contact with, or,
there's
you know,
a wonderful book that Charles Keith...
I'm having a really hard time hearing you guys, because my computer's not working.
It's called The Final Report.
Kind of called the what?
You can go online.
I'm trying to.
And order the book.
Okay.
It's a really valuable resource for, you know, catching up on this case, if anybody that just has no idea about all this stuff we're talking about.
Lisa, that's called The Final Report.
Final Report.
Final
Got
report.
It.
Okay.
All right. Well, listen,
yeah,
I'm going
to go.
Go
to Charles's website.
And, you know something, I'm on. I've got
OKC
Google
bombing.
Up. Hang on a second, and I'm at OKC Building, but I don't know what website y'all are at.
It's
from there.
OKCBombing.org.
Right.
Is the website where you can get that book, and it's a very good book.
Okay.
It can get you up to date.
I'm going to head over there now.
Oh, good.
Hey, peace be with y'all.
We thank for that call. All right, going back, where should we pick up to the point where... Actually, I'm asking you, what do you think happened, and can you give us a timeline?
I was just mentioning about Timothy McVeigh's letter to his sister.
Okay.
And that would be a good resource to start if someone's fresh off on this case. Go online and look that letter up that he wrote in October of 93 to his sister, where he clearly states that he was pulled out of a line, a big group. The official story was that he didn't make it into the special forces and that he left. But what Timothy McVeigh wrote to his sister was that he was chosen to be one of the elite group that was going to perform black ops. And that part of his duties would be flying heroin. It was in the letter, flying heroin out of somewhere. I can't remember off. I don't have it in front of me. And then the second, one of the second line of duties he had would be assassination. And in the letter, he almost sounds kind of disappointed that this is what's going to happen to him. But he's in it, and he knows he can't get out. So it's a real interesting letter, though. It gives you a kind of a look inside where Timothy McVeigh was coming from at that point in time.
Do you guys believe that Timothy McVeigh definitely knew what he was doing, that he knew he was part of, well, that he was the plan, perhaps? Do you believe that he might not have known that he was only part of a bigger plan? In other words, as that caller just said, he pulls up that you know, Ryder truck or whatever with the info bomb, but, you know, that isn't going to make that whole building blast out. So, am I right in suspecting that perhaps there were things laid into the building that he had no idea were there?
I would find that hard to believe, that he's pretty well on his way to, he had agreed to, I feel like, this is just my opinion, that he agreed to do this project,
mm-hmm.
whatever organization he was working for at the time. And I would think that they would have a blueprint of such an operation so fine-tuned that I can't see how anybody wouldn't be able to know, you know, how the whole thing was put together.
Considering who he was spotted with by very credible eyewitnesses, and some of your listeners aren't aware, the FBI refused to accept their 302 witness statements in the Denver office because they would have had to turn it over to the defense counsel during the discovery. So the FBI's whole treatment of this thing, which is absolutely abhorrent, is the fact that, well, if we don't accept the documents, they simply don't exist, which is, it's crazy. You know, just bald face right there, we know that they were covering it up. My take on it is he knew who was involved. He may have not known of everyone, but there was certainly a larger group. And with his military background, he would have had to know that it would have taken an extensive, larger amount of ordnance to take that building down and do the asymmetrical damage.
Mm-hmm.
Building, so he certainly wasn't remiss on that respect at all.
And Jane Graham was one of the witnesses that did see some, I think it was three people inside the building prior to the Murrah bombing. That was, they had wires, and she had stated that they had some kind of blueprints or floor plans, and they were placing something in the underground garage area. And I believe, Chris, I'm right, that her statements were not allowed either. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, she wasn't even called as a witness either in the federal trials or the multi-county grand jury. And again, they just ignored the fact that these witnesses existed, so...
Well, all right, now I'm a little confused. The thing is, Chris, you stated that McVeigh, and I may be wrong about this, you think McVeigh unilaterally knew everybody that was involved in this?
No, he probably didn't know everyone, but
okay.
He knew a larger group than obviously just himself. And there were witnesses that saw him at the scene of the crime with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we could place at least six. What does that tell you? Obviously, he knew who these people were, both on the plan and the commission, and of course, they were involved in the cover-up. So, and then we've had some sources that say that he was on methamphetamines. That obviously you're not thinking straight when you're on that. I'm not giving him an alibi or blaming him for what he's doing, but why would he be in such a frame of mind? I mean, it's insane to think of murdering 169 people and then just simply walking away from it all. So that's still the part of the puzzle we're trying to solve.
All right, let me ask you directly, too. Do we have charges in the building?
Yes, definitely.
Who laid them?
Unexploded ordnance was pulled out by Oklahoma City Police Department and Oklahoma County Bomb Squad personnel.
And there were several witnesses that did see people inside the building prior to the bombings that could have been placing ordinances.
Right.
That were discounted, so there's eyewitness testimony.
And these were not...
Physical evidence is that the columns on the building itself, if you look at the picture... The way the columns were misplaced, as far as where the truck was pulled up, the columns that were taken out weren't the one that wasn't directly in front of the truck is completely wiped out, where the one that's in front of where the truck would have been parked was still partially standing. So it just defies physics how that could have happened.
Do you folks believe, and I know this might be speculation on your part, and I understand that, but it seems to me that building was supposed to come totally down. One, is that your belief also, And two, again, who are the perps who might have laid those charges? Are we talking about our own federal government?
I really can't say for sure if it was anybody in the federal government. We have people that were informants that knew of this in advance. So in a capital murder, if you're involved in the planning commission or the cover-up, you're all equally complicit. To literally nail somebody in the federal government, we can't do that. What we do know is that there was unexploded ordnance in there. So going on the first part of your question, yes, that it was the intention of blowing that building up, the rest of it, within 10 minutes after the initial blast. There were switches on that ordnance that were damaged in the initial blast, and that's why it didn't happen, thank God. Else we'd had a larger loss of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's all guesswork as far as that goes. And there is another book that was written by Timothy McVeigh's cellmate, David Paul Hammer, called Secrets Worth Dying For. Now, how much credence you can give a book like this is one thing, but it's a very interesting book because he does go into quite kind of detail of what he says Timothy McVeigh said about the charges that were placed in the building. And that what he states in the book is that I guess a foreign person, they don't say him by name, I think they give him a pseudonym, but was hired or contracted by one of the special ops people that Timothy McVeigh was working with, is what it says in that book. So, but that's a kind of hard to find book. It's pretty obscure, but I found it to be interesting. Just to, you know, you've got to kind of separate the truth from fiction in that book too, as well as any other book. There's been so many books on this, but I kind of saw almost a grain of truth running through that book. That I would highly recommend anyone really interested in this case should read that. And it starts around page 148, where it really starts going into detail about the whole Oklahoma City bombing and the plan and what happened.
We were told in the mainstream news that was a singular explosion, was McVeigh's truck. And then what happened was, of course, is I'm sure you guys are aware, there were captured original reports, electronic media, radio and TV, that all spoke about multiple explosions. And I believe even Governor Keating came on and said that he had seen one or more devices removed from the building. That being the case, one, is it true that there were more than one explosion, and also that there was other ordnance that was taking out of the building? And if so, do you find that was shielded from the public?
I can answer that directly. I have interviewed people that were at the site, that were working in the medical capacity, that witnessed multiple ordnances coming out of the building that morning. So
being removed undetonated.
There were several witnesses that they don't want to reveal their names, but they have come forward and stated what they saw coming out of the.
Okay, so we have ordnance that was not detonated being taken out.
Along with the several media reports, it was all over the media. There were reported up to three ordinances in the building that were being removed. They did stop the evacuation at one point and made everybody get back. I think it was about 20 minutes or so after their initial blast. It may have been 40 minutes.
We have people in this final report that Lisa referred to. That's like 555 pages long. We, in our investigation that we conducted, I mean, a very professional investigation where we took affidavits from people, some of those written affidavits, some of those video affidavits, people that were, like Lisa just mentioned, that were rescue workers, people that were paramedics, people that were in the triage center. One lady that is not only someone that we interviewed and is in the final report, but also I was involved with a guy that did a short documentary in 1995 that took this lady's, a nurse, an LPN statement on video. It's the only place her video appears. She was in the triage, and there were U.S. Marshals and FBI agents in there. And while they were in there taking care of people, they were also talking about the other bomb they just took out, and they were describing it in some detail.
and talking about how they were fortunate that they got it out of there, et cetera, et cetera. There's two other paramedics that we've interviewed, and they gave us their affidavits, have nothing to gain by giving their stories, only attacks and ridicule over time that they received, several years ago when this first happened. And they had a county, one of them, a lady named Tiffany Bible, she was a paramedic, one of the first people on the scene, had a county deputy sheriff, and I believe it was an ATF officer, it was a federal agent of some type, for sure it was ATF, while everybody was pushed back at one point, like Lisa was just describing, and they were standing there talking to each other, and she was right next to them. They were talking about the device they had just taken out prior to that, that evacuation effort, and they were going into some detail describing that. So, there's a lot of proofs of other devices, eyewitness accounts, but there's also the great body of evidence from experts that have world recognition as being experts in this field, in these fields that would be necessary to make a determination of what kind of damage was done to the building by what type of explosive devices. And it's very clear that there had to be other devices used to do that damage. The amount of damage and the pattern of damage, two very important and two different things. The amount of damage and the pattern of it.
Well, since we've been told on the mainstream news one story, and since we all otherwise know a different one, that there is a discrepancy, what do we make of that necessarily?
Well, here's the way I describe it anymore to make it real simple, and this is the way I've come to understand it myself, is that our government, and particularly some of the agencies, some of the main important agencies that had to do with investigation and law enforcement, intelligence, foreign policy, have actually, to a large degree, been taken over by some other individuals that have interest other than what those agencies and this government was originally formed and intended to do. And I think more and more people are coming to realize that, but there's still yet not enough people that have lost their illusion of this government still working for their best interest. And I think it's important to understand, because this is the way I see it, most FBI agents, most federal employees, most law enforcement people, even at the state and local level, are good people. They're trying to do the job that they were hired to do. But there's some element within our government, particularly at the federal level, that does not have the American people's best interest in mind. And to a large degree, we've been taken over by some force, some organization. And that's why we're having so many problems that we have today. And that's why things like Oklahoma City take place. And then the cover-up occurs, and then you can't really ever seemingly do anything about it because they have people in place and they're able to cut it off, to pass.
Well, it's interesting that this happened on a Democrat's watch because 9/11 happened on a Republican's watch. And I'll tell you, the way I feel most of the listeners for this show is that Republican or Democrat, the whole system has gotten corrupt. Bought into by the corporate global elitists, and I know that's a nefarious term and somewhat nebulous as well, but that, that it doesn't matter what necessarily what administration's in there, be it Republican or Democrat. I think we have government out of control, and these things occur, let me ask you this. Do these events occur to, one, eviscerate the Constitution, and two, put us into a more totalitarian-like state?
Well, see, we were asked this question, and I've been asked this question so many times since day one when I got publicly involved in this in 1995. And it's a no-win situation. The answer is I don't know. We don't know for certain. Now, a lot of people want to argue that point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not intending to argue it. The bottom line is that the net effect of it is that it has caused things to happen like the Patriot Act, and which is, of course, many years down the road from Oklahoma City. But I think the one that was passed right after Oklahoma City was the anti-terrorism bill, if I remember the correct title of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dead in the water. It was not going to pass. And as soon as Oklahoma City happened, well, they
you know, they rushed it through Congress very quickly. And there's been other bills in between that and now the Patriot Act. You know, they've got this Patriot Act, too, that they'd like to get passed now. And these bills that have just further taken away and eroded our constitutional rights and our freedoms. And, you know, personally, I really resent even talking about it because the Supreme Court, over 200 and some odd years, has made a lot of rulings, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And they've even contradicted themselves many times as in 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, they made a ruling in which they said any law, which is, I think this is the exact quote, it's very close, any law that is repugnant to the Constitution is no law at all. So, you know, it's unfortunate we find ourselves today addressing laws that are repugnant to the Constitution. They're totally in violation of it, and we're acting like they're laws, like they're superior. They're not. And so, we've got a very, very big problem in this country. It's being taken over by lawlessness and ignorance and incompetence, a lot of things. But it's not all incompetence. A lot of it's intentional.
Do you see terror as a state-sponsored situation, not only in this country, but across the world? I mean, do we have a common pattern here? And, I mean, you don't have to be experts on it, and you don't necessarily have to speak to it. But it does dawn on me after we see things in London and Spain and Bali. Do we all believe that this is really some kind of Al-Qaeda network, or do we believe that this is a move made by governments who are complicit in saying, listen, we want a one-world government? I mean, I got to, you know, get right to the bottom of it.
Well, I mean, I'm very suspicious that it's Al-Qaeda and those types of organizations. That is what, you know, our government, generally speaking, wants us to believe. I suspect there's something else behind it all. And
I'm going to jump in here. One of the things you might look at, and what investigators look at, is trying to get to the bottom of the financing of the terrorist acts. Once you get to the, you know, perpetrators, then you try to follow the money trail. And that'll lead you in a whole lot of real interesting places. And on the J.M. Berger's website, IntelWire, he goes into great detail, which he backtracks some of the, what he refers to as Al-Qaeda group that might have been involved. The money goes back to the Saudi embassy, for example. So there's all kinds of, you know, ways to look at it. Mm-hmm. But once you follow the money trail back to who's doing it, usually it's someone with a lot of money, power, prestige, and who has to gain, you know, the most from these acts.
But having said that, Lisa, now that we look at OKC, who stands to benefit by that? Would you speak to that?
I'm just kind of reviewing some information today, so I'm going to go ahead but what his theory is that he's backtracked some of this through the Al-Qaeda network out of Florida, New York, and different organizations into the Philippines, where it goes back all the way, like I said, to the Saudi embassy. There was meetings at the Saudi embassy, and they apparently financed these different organizations worldwide, which were rapidly recruiting people. And in fact, in 1995, this guy named Hampton L. was indicted in the United States and charged with planning ammonium nitrate bombs. He was planning bomb attacks.
Mm-hmm.
But what came out in the trial was that he was given a list of 3,000 of our military people that had just been in the first Iraq War, the Gulf War,
mm-hmm.
and their names and addresses, and he was told to recruit them into Al-Qaeda. I don't like the term Al-Qaeda. It's just so broad, but I guess we've all come to use that.
Yeah, I don't like it either.
You know, but I'm just going to use it for the sake of this one.
Well, I have to ask you this last question because we're running out of time, and this is my lean, and I'll just throw it out to you. My particular concern is how much our own people were involved in this. Are we looking at an op? I mean, because the next show I'm going to do after we part is about the FBI being involved in the 93 bombing at the WTC, and I mean they knew it and they let it happen. So, I mean, this is a given fact, even in the New York Times, and I have these articles piled up ready to go. But so, folks, I'm going to ask you this. With regard to federal agencies knowing it and letting it happen, do you want to speak to the probability of that?
I would say that federal agencies are made up of individual people. There's good ones and bad ones. And I think that, if you want to say bad ones, I don't think the bad ones totally allowed it. I mean, they weren't in control of the entire government body. But there just takes a few bad apples to, you know, get this kind of thing through there. Or you know, somebody at high, it had to be probably at high levels of the government.
But there was some kind of complicity. Were,
yeah. What do you mean by complicity?
In other words, there was foreknowledge by some federal agencies like the BATF and the FBI.
Right.
That something's going to happen. Carol
Howell.
Yes.
They had a witness, Carol Howell, an informant inside Elohim City, in fact, that had came back with numerous reports that they were planning on blowing up a federal building. Again.
We're running out of time.
It makes you wonder, were they trying to just catch them in the act, or were they... This was the Rupert in 1993 World Trade Center.
We're out of time, folks. Thank you very much, Chris Samory, Charles Key, Lisa Gariani, for being with us, speaking to the Oklahoma City situation as it stands to this day. Thank you so very much, and I hope you can be back again.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, folks. Bye-bye.